Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Center for Law and Social Policy conference call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments throughout the presentation. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Jody Levin-Epstein. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Robin, and welcome everyone to CLASP's audio conference, Poverty Task Forces, the Experience of Three State Advocates. My guests today are Jim Horan with the Connecticut Association for Human Services, Deborah Schlick with Minnesota's Affirmative Options, Doug Schenkelberg with the Heartland Alliance for Human Needs and Human Rights. This audio conference call got started with a conversation with advocates in New York who were interested in learning from advocates in states which had already established a poverty task force or commission. I'm going to interview my guests on a set of topics, and after each topic, you get to ask your questions or make your own observations. The operator will instruct everyone on how to get a question in. The folks in New York, however, they're going to get to ask the first question after each topic. This audio call is mostly about the initial steps in getting a state-level task force or commission established. The broad topics are, number one, coalition partners, number two, framing, and then a third topic, the unavoidable and pressing issue of the new context, a recession coupled with a financial implosion. Let me make some observation about today's guests. Each of the guests are from states where a poverty reduction commission has been legislated. It doesn't have to be that way. Other commissions have been established and have been created by the governor through executive order. In addition, each of my guests today are from states where the Poverty Reduction Commission includes a target as part of its mission. A target means a poverty reduction goal, a numerical goal linked to a timeline, a deadline for getting to that goal. The legislated target, though, for each of these states is different from the other. In Connecticut, the target is to cut child poverty in half by 2014. In Minnesota, the commission's overall mission is to end poverty by 2020. In Illinois, the legislation calls for a cut in extreme poverty in half by 2015. In addition, the status of the Poverty Reduction Commission differs state by state. In Connecticut, you have the first state in the nation with a legislated target. It started in 2004 and was established to oversee the poverty reduction target. Already, Connecticut has issued reports about its efforts and issued a set of recommendations about how to cut poverty in half, and issued reports and recommendations from an expert panel that suggested priority recommendations. In Minnesota, the legislation came to be in 2006. It established the commission with the task solely of issuing recommendations. It expires this year when its recommendations are released. In Illinois, it was created, the commission, in 2008, just a few months ago. And while it's just getting off the ground, it already is planning a significant summit for next month, December. We will now turn to our first topic, partners. On the topic of coalition partners, can you fill us in on how your commission got started? Was it promoted by the advocacy community, fully hatched without advocacy groups at all involved, or something else entirely? Even if it wasn't started by a group of partners, are you working in coalition now? Were you able to mobilize allies in business or labor to support your initiative? I'm going to start with the oldest first, seniority, Jim Horan with the Connecticut Association. Jim?
Hi. Thanks, Jody, and thanks, everybody, for listening. Our Child Poverty and Prevention Council was started by the Connecticut Commission on Children. They pushed for the legislation with the Connecticut State Legislature and were successful. The legislation was supported by the advocacy community, but all the heavy lifting was really done by the Commission on Children. As you said, it was started in 2004, and advocates met regularly with the Commission on Children to try to influence the council's agenda, because the council is comprised completely of appointees of the governor, the heads of state agencies, and several legislators. The short story is that neither the governor nor powerful legislative leaders have really ever embraced the council or its goals, and the most disappointing aspect of this is that there has not, in fact, been any reduction in child poverty since the legislation was passed in 2004, and we've now had several years to see whether it's working. Despite that bad news, the good news is that having the target in place has really gotten advocates to work much more closely with each other than we have in the past. Just this past September, a couple of months ago, we had a big conference, about 400 people, about 400 people attended, that used to be the Anti-Poverty Agency Conference, but instead it was co-sponsored by 8 organizations together. And that has been a terrific thing to bring all the advocates and nonprofit service providers together. We haven't yet gotten much support from business, gotten a little bit from labor. We're now trying to do more to reach out and attract support from different sectors, including business and labor.
Terrific. And Doug, in Illinois?
In Illinois, actually, the commission came out of a campaign that was initiated by Heartland Alliance.
Your group.
Our group. That we started it in 2006. The campaign's called the From Poverty to Opportunity Campaign, Realizing Human Rights in Illinois. And it is a statewide initiative to end poverty in our state. And we really spent the first year of the campaign, 2007, building up the coalition, building up the membership, working around the state to pull in organizations and individuals into our effort. It wasn't until this past legislative session in early 2008 that we introduced legislation coming out of the campaign to establish the commission in Illinois. One component of the campaign was to have folks endorse the campaign. So we've had, by the time the legislation was introduced, we had around 200 organizations from across the state, and that ranged from statewide service providers, policy groups, to food pantries on the south side of Chicago, and a whole range of individuals, people from all parts of Illinois.
And is 200 an important number in Illinois? I mean, you know, when folks within Illinois see a 200 sign-on from state groups, is that a wow?
It is. It's a combination of that being a relatively high number, but also that it was a fairly diverse set of organizations.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't
okay.
Just the usual suspects. It included municipalities, it included state legislators, it included some business groups, although a very, very, very small number of those groups. So that definitely got people's attention in the process.
Okay.
And so we've been working in coalition since then, since legislation was signed by the governor in August. More groups have gotten involved because it's now, the commission is going to be a real thing. So groups that were may have been hesitant in the past are now more interested. And we've been really working to get the commission filled out. The commission has to involve advocates, people working on these different issues, not just folks from state agencies and legislators, although they're involved as well in that commission. One of the spots on the commission is a representative from labor, so they'll be engaged. As I said already, businesses and labor have not been as involved in the process to date for no particular reason. They just haven't. But hopefully that will change as the commission really gets off the ground and gets moving forward.
Terrific. And Deborah, in Minnesota?
In Minnesota, we were almost a mere opposite of the Illinois process. Our commission came out of the legislature. It was a retiring state legislator who decided, as part of his legacy, inspired by some work going on in the faith community, that Minnesota ought to have a legislative commission to end poverty. So if I had my druthers, we'd do it the Illinois way. As advocates racing to catch up with the legislators, we'd be setting the stage.
Uh-huh.
So in terms of partnership building, what has happened primarily in Minnesota is that the commission has been an opportunity in the nonprofit advocacy world to bring people together out of our particular topical silos. So the homeless advocates, the youth advocates, the employment services advocates. It's a place that people were anxious to find a way where we could we could talk about bigger issues. And it also has been an opportunity for those who are secularly based advocates to work very closely with faith-based advocates and to build bridges. We have not built many bridges yet with business community. Some of our advocates are already closely tied with labor, but haven't brought labor in formally on their own. And we're hoping that we can do that around specific recommendations that come out of the commission. It's amazing how much time and effort it's taken just to build relationships inside our own world.
Deborah, could you expand on what role the Minnesota Affirmative Options as an organization has played in the rolling out of the work of the commission?
Well, Affirmative Options is a coalition of nonprofit organizations from around the state of Minnesota. And
so you're a bunch of partners.
We're a bunch of partners to begin with.
Uh-huh.
Mainly who came together around welfare to work policy.
Uh-huh.
But who had been looking in recent years to say that's not enough. The welfare world doesn't get us enough impact in terms of making the sort of dent. So our role has been twofold. We have served as some sort of shadow staff support to the commission, helping them plan agendas, identify speakers, and we asked and are very grateful that the commission agreed that to be effective, they really needed to talk with low-income people. They needed to be outside the Capitol, and they needed to be outside of formal hearing formats. And so when we put out an invitation to our members to help the commission do listening sessions around the state, members in their local communities help plan those listening sessions, taking commission members to laundromats, on mass transit rides, to congregate dining sites, to home visits, to sort of personally led tours in rural areas. And I think that partnership served us very well.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Robin, if you'll instruct the audience on how to queue up to ask a question, and we've promised New York they get the first question. They need to queue up so that they can get in on the line there, and we'll take their question first. And if you, when you're asking your question, want a particular guest to address it, either Jim, Doug, or Deborah, please articulate that at the outset. Robin?
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they were received, with the exception of New York. And if you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any point your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing pound. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions.
Thank you, Robin. New York must feel so special. Robin, do you have a question there?
I am not seeing a question from New York. However, we do have a question coming from Martha Poffett. If you could please pose your question.
Sure. Hi, this is Martha Poffett from New York.
Ah, there you go.
this is to all three. Given the 09 economy, what public policy interventions are you specifically promoting that you believe will make the most difference?
Can I clarify? We're trying to do this session so that the questions relate to each topic at the end of each topic. We plan to address the recession as our third topic, so we are concentrating on questions, observations, little and big asks about the whole role of developing coalition partners. So if you could throw a question at us with respect to building partnerships, particular kinds of partnerships, please throw one at us.
Okay, thank you, and I will. you know, it's striking the lack of the business community's involvement. I just wondered sort of your game plan and what you think the messaging is that you hope will resonate with why poverty is bad for business.
Jim, you were mentioning that you were hoping to bring in some businesses. You'd had a little bit of success, not as much as you'd like. Maybe you could take that one first.
Sure. We have reached out to the business community, and I've met with a number of business leaders. And what I found resonates the most with them is to connect poverty with the current and future workforce, which is in some ways no great surprise. In Connecticut, we're a very slow-growth state. When you look at where our future workforce is coming from, many of them, much of the future workforce, 40%, I believe, is expected to come from our big cities, where the quality of education and the rate of quality of education is worst and the rate of poverty is highest. And so that really concerns business leaders, and they're also concerned with the quality of the present workforce, where Connecticut has traditionally had a highly educated workforce and been a wealthy state in part because of that. But that's beginning to change. Other states are catching up with us, other countries. So when I've met with business leaders, that seems to be their greatest concern. But I will say, even with finding that common ground with them, it's not the same as getting them to the table, which is harder than finding the common ground. And part of what I've heard from business leaders is that we need to be at their table so that when they're talking about these issues, people from my organization or other advocates are there. So just last week, for example, there was a meeting sponsored by the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, which is sponsored by utilities and big banks, and I was there and participating in workshops talking about connecting poverty and all the issues that we care about with the issues of the workforce and economic growth that business leaders care about.
Wow. Jim, that sounds really exciting. I know it's sort of late-breaking, and you'd wished it happened earlier, but that's pretty exciting that you've been able to move it that far.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like it's moved further than it has, but that is where we are. We're able to get some business leaders to the table talking along those lines, but I don't want to overstate the case of where we are.
And Doug, Deborah, any comments, reactions?
I'm learning from Connecticut.
And yeah, we don't have a lot we've learned here, an observation and what we're going to try. Similar to Connecticut's experience, a little different, but similar dynamics. We had a group of business and community leaders work with Brookings a couple of years ago to talk about what economic, racial, and geographic disparities are meaning for the state's competitiveness. So they put out a report on those disparities costing Minnesota economically. Mm-hmm. They, however, even organizing in their own circles, have been unable to find a comfortable way to follow up on that politically.
Mm.
And I think that's the ongoing struggle is what politics they want to see to answer the problems they're identifying. What advice we had from one of our local foundations that we're going to try and follow up on is to build connections with culturally and racially specific chambers of commerce. Immigrant-based ones, Latino ones, African-American chambers, and to find business leaders out of those communities to instead of continuing to go to the same sort of mainstream headquarter business offices.
Hmm.
So we're going to give it a shot.
Great. Robin, any other questions lined up?
Yes, our next question is coming from Tom Willard. Please pose your question.
Tom Hilliard?
Yes, your line is live.
Okay. I think actually I tried to take us out of the queue. The question was asked by Martha.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to our next topic. Robin? Okay, great. The next topic is framing. And a key question is, how did you successfully frame your campaign? Did you frame your campaign differently than you first thought you would when you tested the waters? Did you change, or were you set with something from the get-go? And looking back on it, would you have changed anything you'd done in terms of how you'd framed your approach to having a commission? You know, someone has suggested that a basic dilemma for elected officials is that they mainly consider themselves as acting on behalf of the middle class. How did you get past that, or did you feel like you needed to, so that they would take on and tackle the issue of poor families to move the commission? Again, we're going to go with our elder first, that is to say our oldest state commission. Jim Horan in Connecticut.
Sure. Ours is called the Connecticut Child Poverty and Prevention Council. It was originally a Child Poverty Council, and they added prevention later because of pre-existing legislation. I think by talking about child poverty, there was a hope that it would be more appealing than just poverty or poor people generally to start with children. And there was a good understanding among council members that children are in poverty because their parents or families are in poverty. But still, I think it's problematic to focus on poverty per se, in part because of what you said, Jody, about legislators wanting to appeal to the middle class. And it's really very clear that the two governors since the legislation passed, who are Democrats, and who are Republicans, and legislative leaders who are Democrats, have never really embraced the goal. So over time, what we've tried to do to put some outside pressure on the council is to, in some ways, reframe the issue more broadly. Advocates in Connecticut earlier this year had a framing session with Doug Gould Communications, who had done a lot of work for the Ford Foundation on a project called For an Economy That Works for All, and that's available on the Douglas Gould website. And Doug Gould's basic message was that you need to be broad. You shouldn't talk about poverty, but to talk about things like opportunity and prosperity. We called our recent conference that I mentioned Prospering Communities, Thriving Families, because my organization is launching an opportunity and prosperity campaign, and we're talking about prosperity for all and linking that to economic growth and to jobs. And we think that this is something that will be more appealing in the long run than focusing exclusively on child poverty.
Jim, let me just ask a clarifying question there. Do you never use the word poverty, or is it that you're pitching your headlines to use these more aspirational terms?
Right. It's not that we never use poverty. It's more the aspirational and wanting to put the positive spin on things. Instead of saying we're against poverty, we're saying we're for creating prosperity for everybody. But we don't shy away from the goal of ultimately trying to reduce poverty, and not just for children, but for everyone.
Terrific. And Doug?
Well, our campaign is a human rights campaign. So we very explicitly from the beginning had decided we were going to use the human rights framework to talk about poverty as a human rights issue. For one reason is that Heartland Alliance as an organization sees itself as a human rights organization, that all the work that we do, which is primarily direct service work, providing housing, addressing healthcare needs, things like that, are human rights issues. And so our feeling was what we need to do is shift the conversation from a conversation about poverty being dealt with as an act of charity to one as basic obligations in our society, and using the human rights framework to do that. And in that vein, we are very attuned to trying to do it in an accessible way, not spending a lot of time, and a lot of people have a lot of assumptions about what you mean when you say human rights, that you're talking about the United Nations, you're talking about these foreign, distant things that have nothing to do with us. But we really try to use it in a way similar to what they're trying to do in Connecticut, which is use it as an aspirational thing. We call the campaign the From Poverty to Opportunity campaign, realizing human rights in Illinois. So really not necessarily focusing on the negative, but focusing on where we want to be, drawing on a lot of the work of the Opportunity Agenda, their messaging work around progressive issues, around using the opportunity frame, and some of their more recent work around how do you make the human rights framework accessible to different audiences. And we've used that throughout. It's been fairly successful, probably more successful than I would have assumed it would be in terms of people grabbing onto it and feeling empowered by it. I wouldn't say that if you went up to members of the Illinois legislature that they would say, I did this because they talked about poverty as a human rights issue. But I would say there was a lot of folks that got excited about the campaign and engaged because we gave them a new language, a new way of talking about it, which I think is equally important, if not in some ways more important, in terms of engagement and people putting time and energy in. What the other piece in terms of the framing in our the resources we used in speaking to the issue of the middle class is using data, being able, you know, one of the things we do at Heartland is we put out an annual report on poverty in Illinois that really catalogs all aspects of what's happening with poverty that we've done for about 10 years now. And that report has gotten to a point where it garners a great deal of media attention every year when it comes out. It has a ranking or a, not a ranking, but a scorecard for counties in the state about how they're doing in terms of poverty, which journalists pay attention to. And we use that data to our advantage. I'll give you one example. There was a particular legislator, a Republican from Central Illinois, who was approached by the sponsor of the legislation for the commission and asked to sponsor, sign on as a sponsor. The legislator said, no, I'm not interested. Everything's fine in my district. My families are doing okay in my district. We don't need this. When we were informed by the sponsor about this conversation, we put together a fact sheet detailing the reality of poverty in this legislator's district, showing that the extreme poverty rate is higher in his district than it is in the rest of the state, that the number of kids living in poverty in his district is about 5% higher than the average for the state. And our sponsor brought that fact sheet back to this legislator, and then he signed on as a sponsor as a result. So numbers mean something. When you can make a vocal, it has a certain power. So.
Excellent. And in Minnesota, Deborah, your framing issues.
Well, we were given the frame. The legislation that created the commission named the commission, a commission to end poverty. We have worried over that name from the beginning. We thought there were two scary words, end and poverty. But we thought in the end, and we talked about should we ask them to rename themselves early on. And we decided not to because we thought, first of all, we as advocates couldn't ask them to do something short of ending. And secondly, the danger of not naming poverty is that we slide off focus. And as we begin to invoke middle class language, we start picking up middle class issues and not really picking up some of the fundamental things that help people move out of poverty. The director of the commission, Gregory Gray, I've heard him say publicly that he has found the name a boon. Because he says there is no place he doesn't go that when he announces a name that it doesn't get attention. It sometimes invokes debate, but he says it engages people, the sort of ambition of it. So he's found it a useful tool in that way. All of that said, we are asking as they wrap up their work, and they're due to put recommendations down on paper to the for the full legislature at the end of December, that perhaps now's the time to segue. And so to label their recommendations in the Connecticut sense in a more aspirational way, and to talk about poverty as a measure of progress towards those more aspirational goals. We haven't found the exact right words, but we've been toying with some and asking them to toy with some.
Okay.
Oh, and one other point on that. Like Illinois, I think what the name did for us is for our own troops, it galvanized and engaged people who were very hungry to say, yes, there is poverty. I know it and see it every day, and it's time for someone to pay attention.
Hmm. Robin, could you again instruct the audience on how to line up for questions? And this, again, will be questions about this topic, which is framing. And, again, we'll take the first question from New York if New York queues up. So, Robin?
Thank you. The floor is once again open for questions. If you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Again, we ask if using a speakerphone while posing your question to pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Okay, our first question again is coming from Martha Poffitt. Please pose your question.
Until we're interested in this topic. So I just wondered if you might address the issue of attracting revenues to your model and what grants or foundations are warmed up to this and what messaging framing helps.
And is that for anybody?
Yes.
Okay. Jim, you want to take that one first?
Sure. I mean, you know, of course, what we'd really like is to have state funding to back up these recommendations. That there was a report issued by the council after about a year, and it had 67 recommendations, and they were very good, but there were way too many in having 67. But the big problem has been that the state has not actually funded the recommendations. For example, the governor twice vetoed creating a state earned income tax credit, which was one of the top recommendations. In terms of foundation or other support,
Jim, before you get off of that, could you mention your your food stamp funding stream?
Sure. You mean the recent legislation?
Yes.
Yeah. So one thing that has happened positively is that Connecticut, the legislature passed legislation this past session to cap the Food Stamp Employment and Training, or FSET, program. And the way this works basically is that every state gets a certain allocation, but then there's also other funding that states can tap into for food stamp eligible populations for education and training purposes. And Connecticut was not tapping into the money at all. I think New York State actually is one state that's done a very good job. Another one in our neck of the woods was Vermont that have done a good job, but a lot of states haven't gotten anything. And legislation was just passed to enable us to begin to tap into that. And in part, that was because of work that the Casey Foundation, the Annie E. Casey Foundation Program Officer for Connecticut, did with the legislature to help make that happen. And Casey is one of the foundations that has been very good in trying to figure out how to leverage this legislation into positive programming at the state level. And there have been other foundations in the state that have also been excited about the goal and been willing to come together more than our foundation community traditionally does to try to make positive things happen. But it's been on a relatively small scale so far, and we're trying to leverage that into more support from the foundation community, both in terms of some support for public advocacy, which foundations are always reluctant to do, but also in terms of backing up programs that are working with some financial support.
Robin, do you have questions from other states there?
Yes, we do.
If we'll take one on that and then get into the next topic.
Okay, great. Our next question is coming from Gwen Edie Samuel. Please pose your question.
Uh-oh.
Ma'am, your line is live.
Hi. I have a question, and I don't know if this ties in to the framing. I'm hoping it does. When Deborah, I believe you talked about the racial disparity report that you did and how you tied into, you wanted to tie into minority businesses to get the buy-in. Is
mm-hmm.
that basically, how is that tied into your, is that part of your, was that part of your initial plan, or was that through other studies that saw that was a missed target area?
A couple comments in answer. We didn't do the study that talked about the racial, economic, and geographic disparities. A business-led group did that, which was what made it particularly valuable. So instead of advocates, and particularly, you know, poverty advocates producing that, it was a group of business leaders who had that produced for them by hiring Brookings, and who with that study made the message, this is a weakness to our economic growth. And then the truth about poverty in Minnesota is that we're a state with very low poverty rates when you compare us to most other states. We're sixth or seventh lowest if you look across our population as a whole. If, however, you look at our racial disparities, we have some of the widest disparities in the nation. So the degree that poverty concentrates by race in Minnesota is very stark.
Is this report online? Or?
Pardon me?
Is this report, Brooks' report, is it online?
Yes, it's from the Itasca Group, and
mm-hmm.
it's called Minding the Gap. I don't have the address right here, but I bet if you Google that. So we are working, as I said, one of our roles has been kind of to be shadow staff to the commission. So we have been talking with the commission staff and the leadership of the commission about how they're going to address race in their final report. and have been urging them to make sure they address it, and secondly, to echo what came out of the Itasca group, how Minnesota's future depends on it doing much better at diversity than it has done to date.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to reading about that one. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We're now going to turn to our third topic, the recession. With a 6.5% unemployment rate right now that some predict will go to 8.5 or even much higher by 2010, and with states, most states, cutting budgets in ways we've not seen in decades, what does that mean for your poverty reduction task force? Do you expect poverty to be taken more seriously, less seriously? Do you think some of the recommendations are going to change to fit the harsh economic and budget environment? What are you doing in this unbelievably stark reality that we're all operating in right now? And again, I'm going to start with Jim in Connecticut.
Sure. Well, obviously, having the economic meltdown affects low-income people more than anybody else. And so I think in some ways we're going to get more attention. The council will get more attention because of the economic meltdown. On the other hand, as in other states, we're now facing a deficit that we didn't have before, or a greater deficit than we had before, and so it's going to be even harder to get any money. And as I said, there was very little money allocated previously, and I think it'll be even harder now. So we're going to be on the defense as opposed to the offense. But as Rahm Emanuel said recently, hopefully there's opportunity in this crisis, and that we can make some good things happen out of it. So, as I said, the governor has twice vetoed an earned income tax credit. I don't know if the Democrats who control the legislature and have, at least on paper, a veto-proof majority will have the stomach to push that this year. I don't think that they would do it on its own, but there's probably going to have to be some pretty broad tax restructuring to close the huge budget gap that is developing. And so maybe as part of the tax restructuring, they can build in an EITC, and it's possible that they'd be able to either override a veto, or that the governor would be less likely to veto an EITC at this point when it's so clear that it can help some families get out of poverty. Another aspect of this is that we need to focus on short-term needs and not just longer-term needs because of the crisis that has developed. And so already our legislature, for example, has allocated additional money for energy assistance, not really to address the child poverty reduction target specifically, but just looking at what the needs are. And so they did put some additional money into energy assistance. Now, I think as we go into the legislative session, there'll be some pressure to cut back on the state's SCHIP program, for example, to reduce eligibility and things like that. And whether having the child poverty target on the books will be helpful for advocates who are trying to prevent bad things from happening remains to be seen.
And Doug in Illinois.
Well, in Illinois, I mean, some of you may have seen today that the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities put out a report about, you know, that shows the correlation between rising unemployment and rising poverty. And based on their data, we're looking at probably another 2 million people, 2 million kids living in extreme poverty by late 2009 based on unemployment estimates. For Illinois, that means, you know, conservatively, that we might have around 80,000 more youth in extreme poverty over the next couple of years. And this is at the same time when we're saying that we want to cut extreme poverty. So we're met with quite a challenge. There's nothing in our legislation that says we just want to hold steady. We want to bring it down. So there's a couple things that we need to do to meet this. One, and this is something we've said from the beginning, is that we need to look at poverty more comprehensively than strictly the official federal poverty line. That doesn't give us an accurate measurement in terms of how different interventions, different income supports are impacting families. So we need to be able to measure that change and that impact on families so we can make a stronger argument for why we would need additional income supports, especially at a time like this. And we would also help us make an argument around that some economists have been making when we're talking about economic stimulus, where does that money go and where should it go? And that getting that money into the hands of people who need it the most, that have the fewest resources, makes the most sense in terms of stimulating the economy. And so that more comprehensive measure makes more sense. You know, and I completely agree with Jim in terms of this, looking at this crisis as an opportunity. I think, well, it'll be an opportunity as long as we talk about it in the right way. In Springfield, you know, we, Springfield being our state capital, we know that folks experiencing poverty have been living in an economic crisis for years. And this is just making it that much harder for them. So how do we take advantage of this situation where there's greater awareness on the part of our legislators to act and get them to move in the right way on things that we may have pushed out maybe further in our plan for aiming for a 2015 goal that might make sense for us to push now because there's a political will with the current crisis to get it done. All that against the backdrop of us having about a $3 billion deficit in Illinois that we have to fill. So how do we do that and recognize that there's very real economic constraints that we're dealing with?
And Deborah, Minnesota recession, your mission.
So the honest answer is it panics me many days. And then, as the other two have said, but I got cut off for a little bit, so I didn't get to hear everything Doug and Jim said. But we also are putting a lot of time and energy into how to make sure that what the commission has to say in December, instead of sounding irrelevant, sounds like it's at the center, makes it clear that it's at the center of what needs to happen. And I think that's where we invoke the Doug Gould-type language, that as we rebuild our economy, we have to make sure we're rebuilding an economy that works for everyone and leaves no one behind. And so there are a couple concrete things. Doug was just speaking about having some measures. So we have worked, thanks to you, Jody, of connecting our commission to the Urban Institute to do some modeling, some very, good, hard, quantitative modeling of what might some specific policy proposals do, not only in terms of numbers of Minnesotans moved out of poverty, but where does it raise revenues for the state? Where does it cut back in spending and other assistance programs so that we can have that sort of impartial, credible information to go behind policy proposals? We also are looking at, and this maybe gets a little bit to Martha's question way back at the beginning, trying to urge the commission to put at the forefront of its recommendations a wage subsidy program. Minnesota did this in the early 1980s during a time of high unemployment. It was an emergency employment program, got lots of folks to work. So we're trying to both build the case and the picture of what that would look like to do now.
And was that measured successfully? I mean, did it show positive outcomes when it happened in these earlier decades? Are you able to promote it as repeating something known to be successful?
We are able to. I was just in a conversation about this morning, and I'm quickly doing the history. It's clear we have information that at the time it was successful at getting people into work, and particularly getting people into work in the private sector. There were some public and nonprofit jobs, but it did work in the private sector. What we don't have are any longitudinal studies about where did those folks go over time. We certainly can find people who got jobs through that program. We can find businesses who participated at the time who look back on it and say it worked. So we will... Our hope is to get them to advance a couple proposals where it's clear to the public why this is timely as opposed to a luxury. But we will hear our state's budget forecast a week from Friday, and, the guesses are anywhere from $2 to $6 billion. So,
all right.
It will not be a pretty
study. This is Jim in Connecticut. If I could just respond to something that Deborah mentioned, we are doing economic modeling. The Child Poverty Council is doing economic modeling of some of its recommendations. They've narrowed down that long list of 67 to 13, and some of those 13 are being modeled by the Urban Institute, which I think also did the economic modeling for the Center for American Progress report on moving from poverty to prosperity. And so we're looking forward to seeing those results. There's actually going to be a report from the Urban Institute at the next meeting of our Child Poverty and Prevention Council, which is on December 23rd in the afternoon. And I just want to mention that having that meeting on December 23rd in the afternoon is somewhat indicative of where the council stands in the eyes of government, that that's when they schedule. It's a horrible time.
Robin, if you could instruct the audience on how to ask questions of these guests on the topic of recession, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, the floor is now open for your questions and comments. If you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Once again, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Our first question is coming from Tom Hilliard of the SCAA. Please pose your question.
Yeah, you know, when you're looking at the effect of the recession as a context on what you're doing, I guess there are two aspects of it. One that you've addressed is how you get legislators and the public to care about your priorities. But I'm also interested in another issue, which is how it relates to the goals that you set. I gather Connecticut and Illinois are both calling for 50% reductions in the number of people in poverty. Minnesota is seeking to end poverty. And I'm just wondering if for the target legislators and people who work for the governor and the public generally, do those goals start to seem unrealistic when changes in the economy swamp whatever modest progress you're making or hope to make?
Jim, why don't you go first?
Sure. I'll just say briefly, I think there's a good chance that that will be the case. In a way, it's still early, too early to tell, but I am concerned that when we start talking about reducing poverty, that that becomes seemingly impossible if you have a multi-billion dollar state budget deficit and other problems in the economy.
Doug?
I think yes and no. I mean, just in the same way a year ago people would not have predicted the situation we're in right now, I think it's hard for us to predict what our economy is going to look like 2-3 years from now. So given that we're looking at a longer-term goal, I think what opportunities are provided right now where we have these massive deficits are different from the opportunities we might be provided in 2012, 2013, when ideally the economy is looking a lot better. So I think that's definitely something we have to keep in mind.
Deborah?
The honest answer is I think it's hard to know what comes out of this. What I remind myself and when I'm talking with others about this is that some of our most successful anti-poverty work was done during the Great Depression, and that our grandparents put in place solutions to that depression that held up through generations. And so that goes back to this sense of this, we really do have to rebuild our economy at a point like this. So what are some important structural things we're going to do in that rebuilding that are not only about the momentary crisis, but about, again, that Doug Gould language, an economy that works for all, works for everyone as we come out of this. And, again, because of our racial disparities, that we don't adopt some of the exclusionary practices from past efforts.
Robin, is there another caller?
There is. Our next question is coming from Vicki Selkow of the Wisconsin Council. Please pose your question.
Hi, everybody. I guess I have two questions that are both related to each other. In terms of the recession, are you worried that any kind of proactive agenda focused on investments at this point is going to be viewed as very kind of laughable in this climate? It's one thing for the feds, I think, to talk about spending at this point, but it's quite another to talk about it at the state level. And related to that, I'm curious how all three of you are preventing or dealing with splintering of your anti-poverty allies who are likely to need to only fight for sort of the programmatic needs and short-term priorities of their own particular program area as it relates to poverty and perhaps lose interest in a broader poverty push given the economic circumstances in the state.
Sure. This is Jim. I think, like I said before, it's going to be very tough to make a positive push for any new money or any new programs given the current environment. But I do think that we have to really look for where the opportunities can be so that if there's tax restructuring, are there positive tax policies that we could incorporate into that? I agree with what Deborah was saying in terms of this is the time to think big and think long-term in some ways because we have a crisis. We want to put policies and programs in place that can help over the long term. And I was speaking with a state senator last week who's the head of the Human Services Committee, and I said, you know, what do you think as far as tax policies or things that you want to do? And he said, well, if we're going to do something, I want to do it big because I don't want to just have little half measures that aren't really going to do much and won't do much in the long term. So I think that we really do have to think about those longer-term possibilities. And as far as the splintering, that is a danger that can occur in this environment where everybody's just trying to protect their specific program. I'm excited, though, that so far it appears to me that advocacy organizations are really trying to work with each other and to reach out beyond our small nonprofit service provider and advocacy community to others to figure out bigger long-term solutions. So there's a tax policy group that's formed on a kind of ad hoc basis in our state that involves our traditional advocacy allies, but also is involving mayors of big cities, labor unions, the faith community, and others to start to work together. And I've been at other tables that even include the business community where they've said, well, let's draw a line in the sand. That was a couple of months ago before the full scale of the budget crisis and the financial meltdown was so obvious, and it's still, you know, emerging day by day. So I don't know whether a line in the sand that says no cuts to human services can really hold as things get worse. But I do think that there will be at least some pressure to say we need to use the state's rainy day fund, we need to start looking at revenue options and not just at budget cuts.
Robin?
Can,
our next question, yes?
Yes, you have another call?
I do. Our next question is coming from John Kafalis. Please pose your question.
Yes, thank you. This is John Kafalis. I'm a state rep in Colorado, state representative. And actually, I appreciate getting through. I was trying on the previous areas of topical areas, and I wasn't successful. But one question I have just goes back to the food stamp allocation. I'm wondering if someone could send me a copy of that legislation that, as I understand it, allows the legislature to better leverage some of the food stamp dollars to help with education and training programs? That would be one question.
I can do that.
Is that
Jody? This is Jody. Yeah, I'll do that.
And that would be helpful. Thank you. And I guess in terms of the current topic with regard to the recession, you know, in Colorado, you know, we're dealing with this like everyone else.
John, but you need to tell everyone in the audience what you've achieved already in Colorado, where you're coming from in terms of what you created in Colorado, so
right,
they know.
Right, right. Well, yes, of course. And, well, basically we formed something called the Common Good Caucus back in 07, and I've actually in the process of drafting legislation to formalize that as the Common Good Task Force, which would have legislative council staff support, and which would look at developing a more of a strategic plan tied into a targeted poverty reduction goal. So we're in the works of doing that, and I'm excited about those possibilities. You know, we've been meeting with the governor and other stakeholders, and of course, you know, these times are very challenging, and the governor does seem to be reluctant to use the P word a lot, and I can certainly understand that, but we're trying to, you know, find some common ground in terms of how we frame these issues. One of the things that I was at this morning here at the state capitol in Denver, a bipartisan job creation economic growth committee convened, and they're going to be meeting at least a half a dozen times between now and when our session starts January 7th, and there's a big push on figuring out the most effective ways to look at job creation, and what I'm going to be providing input on is how we can frame this issue of of economic development and job creation through the lens of doing a better job of addressing poverty in our state. So that's underway, and I think that's all I have to say at this point. I'd like to get more specific information about the food stamp allocation issue, because we are trying to increase food stamp participation here in Colorado. One of the pushbacks we've gotten is that staffing at the county level processes these applications is not sufficient to deal with an increased volume, although we are starting to see more and more people. So there's a backlog. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Well, no, what I'll do is, John, I will send you what I have and CC Jim so he can send you additional material that he may have that might be useful to you. But let's make it a quid pro quo. Will you send me, so that I can send to everybody on this audio conference call, any nuggets that you come up with regarding how to frame economic development and addressing poverty in that context, and so we can all learn from what you're figuring out in Colorado?
Yes, and if I may, Jody, very quickly, one more comment is that, the earlier discussion about, reaching out to the business community in where I come from, northern Colorado, Fort Collins, Larimer County, we've had some very good success in the past year because there were a series of articles in 07 from the local newspaper that showed this dramatic increase in child and family poverty. And as a result, through the United Way, a mobilization of the community happened, and Pathways Past Poverty, and that's also involved the local economic development group, Northern Colorado Economic Development Corporation. And just as an example, they raised $30,000 and commissioned an economic analysis of what are some of the root causes in our region of poverty, and they just presented that to the community just a week ago.
Stop there, because what needs to happen is you and I need to get on the phone, and I need to collect from you some nuggets that describe this effort so I can send that back out to the group as well, because that's a really very exciting concrete development.
Yes, it is.
And there may be some models there in terms of the steps that were taken to achieve this that other people could benefit from. So why don't you and I get on the horn again and do that as well and circulate it? So we've got a lot of sharing we've got to do in terms of some lessons out of Colorado. And, John, that's terrific. Any other call? John, are you good? You have another question?
No, I'll be fine. I'm good for now. Thank you.
Okay, super. Robin, anyone else?
Yes, we have another question coming from Gwen E.D. Samuel. Please pose your question.
Yes, this is in regard to messaging. I mean, because we have the economic crisis is affecting all walks of life, the majority of the middle class, and, of course, our impoverished communities. And my concern is that there's going to be different senses of urgency message, given to certain communities.
Mm-hmm.
So people are not going to know where to even focus. And I think so far, I'm from Connecticut, so I think we're doing pretty well in talking about the urgency, but I don't hear a clear single message because it's still up in the air. And I just wanted to hear from the different areas, how have you started to, or have you started to outreach to communities concerning this? And I remember the gentleman, I want to say from Illinois, and I like how you started from the community first. So you're to end the poverty campaign started in the trenches, what I understood it to be, which is, I think, great, as opposed to starting from the top down. I think you started from the bottom up. So I just wanted to hear, has anyone started their, what have they started to roll out to outreach to the community?
Doug, why don't we start with you from Illinois, describing your efforts there, and then we'll weave with others.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, we started with the community. We held some 20 forums around the state in 2007. I think the key for us, now that we have a commission and that's established, that it doesn't start to exclude those people we've worked really hard to engage from day one. The commission has built into it public hearings, other opportunities for engagement of the broader public. But it's really important to us that our campaign that created the commission remain an independent body that's engaging, in particular, people who are experiencing poverty or have experienced communities that are more impacted, as well as the broader public, to be able to, one, share their stories about what they're experiencing and how this current crisis, as it's being framed, is impacting them and their lives and what they need in their lives to be improved, and how we can translate that into real policies and resource changes, so that it's not just about policy wonks sitting around talking about it, but people on the ground really engaged in the process. And, you know, I think we're going to have to figure that out as we go along, to make sure that the commission is hearing them and our campaign is doing its job.
Terrific. Jim, do you have something to add?
Well, Gwen's aware of what we're doing in Connecticut, but one thing that we have done, for example, is have a series of dinners with residents of low-income communities to talk to them about our Opportunity and Prosperity campaign and to ask their opinion about what's needed, what's working, what's not working, and how we move forward. But I agree with what Doug is saying and what Gwen is saying, too. We really need to involve low-income people in everything that we do, and too frequently in the advocacy community, we're advocating on behalf of low-income people, but we don't actually go to them and ask their views, or we do it at the end and in a kind of token way, and that's really unacceptable, and it's important that we engage low-income people right from the start in all of our work.
And Deborah.
Well, amen. so we have, and I think all of those points, and I think that our legislators of our commission going out and having real conversations with low-income people, number of who continue to then follow and participate in work groups, is a very powerful thing. It's much harder to look someone in the face and decide you can write off whole swaths of the population than it is just looking at numbers on a piece of paper. And I think we will remind particularly, we're definitely a bipartisan, nonpartisan coalition, which I think is easy in poverty work. I don't think we have automatic friends in either party. And with we call them DFLers, Democrat Farmer Labor, but Democrats in Minnesota, we will remind them that the elections turned this time on the participation of people who had been previously disenfranchised and felt no stake. And to just remind them that if policymakers are clear that they're going to produce, there's a political gain, not just a sort of altruistic gain.
And on that note, I think we're going to end this particular audio conference. I want to thank everybody for joining us. I want to thank the folks in New York for suggesting this audio conference call. And I particularly want to thank Jim Horan with the Connecticut Association for Human Services, Doug Schenklenberg with the Illinois Heartland Alliance Institute on Poverty, and Deborah Schlick with the Minnesota Affirmative Options. Thank you all. Have a great day. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This does conclude today's teleconference. We appreciate your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time, and have a wonderful day. Did somebody grab Angela? Somebody has her. She's green. I hear Julie talking. It's probably her.